Today's episode of Line 1, Your Health Connection, was pre-recorded. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during the show.
Good morning, Alaska, and welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Today's guest, Jessica Leahy, is way up there on my short list of great interviews. She has been on the program three times discussing her best-selling books, The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation, both of which I have read and regularly recommend to parents. Jessica has agreed to return to Line 1, but this time to share her story and discuss the work she continues to do to improve the lives of children and families. If you've missed my previous discussion with Jessica, I would encourage listeners to find those in the Line 1 archives. Welcome to the program, Jessica. Thanks for joining us again on Line 1.
Thank you so much for having me. I always have so much fun talking with you.
It's always fun. Quick programming note, we are we're pre-recording today's conversation, so we will not be able to take phone calls or emails, so you can just kind of sit back and enjoy the conversation. All right, so before we get going with the meat of, you know, some of the work that you're doing, I'd like to start off with getting a little bit of your background for people who may have not heard. I was looking back, I think it's been like 3 years since maybe the addiction inoculation was since then, but seems like it's been a long time.
So
I'm really excited to have you back, and I'd like for you to catch people up on who you are, what you've been working on, how you got to this point in your life, and just share a little bit about yourself.
I'm one of those people who is very lucky to have had a very winding road. I'm one of those people that likes to try a lot of different things, and I like to jump headfirst into things. And so I've been really fortunate. I've gotten to do some really cool stuff. I've been to law school. I thought I was going to do juvenile justice work, and I found teaching while I was in law school at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And that sort of headed me in the teaching direction. I literally came home from that first day of teaching. I was teaching at the Duke Talent Identification Program, a class called Democracy in, Law in a Democratic Society. And it was so much fun. And I came home from that first day of teaching, and my husband could see from looking at me that I was sunk. I mean, that I was going to be teaching, and that was the end of the story. He even joked, are you even going to finish law school? I was just lit up inside. But I'd gotten to do lots of other stuff. I'd worked in like pediatric HIV work, which is very cool because my husband ended up going into HIV medicine. He's an infectious diseases doc. Mm-hmm. So, at least I can understand most of what he's doing at work. He's a medical ethicist as well. And, you know, it's been really fun. I was a teacher in middle school and high school for over 20 years. I got to teach for 5 years in a drug and alcohol rehab for adolescents. Still my favorite teaching job I've ever had. I've gotten to work as a prevention coach and work with people who are actively brand new to recovery in an inpatient rehab. It's cool. I have what I constantly refer to as the coolest job, which is I get to get curious about something, whether it's, you know, how overparenting affects learning and motivation in kids and what it's doing to kids over the long run, and or, you know, substance use prevention, like what really works, what doesn't work, what's myth, what's reality. And so I get curious about these things, and I go out and I spend a year researching them before I ever write the proposal for the book. I get to write a proposal and get paid to write about these things and sort of translate the science for people who don't want to dive headfirst into the science. And actually, since we last spoke, the addiction inoculation was given the media award by the Research Society on Alcohol, like the scientists that do the research on alcohol and substance use and substance use disorder. And I got to go out to their conference just recently in Bellevue, Washington, and it was so cool. I was hanging on by a thread to some of the really deep science, but it was really fun. And I live tweeted the whole conference and had a blast.
That's great.
So that's basically what's been going on here. And I live in Vermont in the middle of the woods. So it's great.
That's right. Yeah. I was thinking, as you know, as you were talking, one of the things I really love about your books is the fact that they come from, it comes from a place of passion and then of deep knowledge. Like there's something you're interested in, and then you go and you dig and you look and you make sure that what you're putting out there is legitimate and has some teeth behind it, right? But it's also done in really fun ways and with a lot of humor, and it's easy to read. A lot of these, you know, the parenting books, it's slogging through through lots of stuff. It can be. But I really enjoyed
I really appreciate that. In fact, I was hoping that the word humor would get into sort of the flap copy, the notes about, you know, what the addiction inoculation is all about. When you pick up the book and you look in the inside flap copy, I wanted to say, put at least one word in there that there's some humor. And my publisher was like, nope, no room for humor here, which is the problem. I think there's this line that seems to, you know, if you want to be taken seriously, you can't also be funny. And I think that's just not true. Some of my favorite writers, about whether it's about eels or owls or foxes or all the stuff that I love to read, that sort of the natural world and translating the science for a more popular audience, most of those people, you know, there's a lot of humor there. So that's, I'm very grateful for your comments.
Absolutely. And you know, if you go to any sort of recovery center, there's a lot of humor there. I mean, there's there's a lot of people telling stories and laughing, and it's part of the healing process, right?
Yeah, it tends to get, sometimes it's pretty dark humor, but yes, there's a lot of humor around recovery, because I think there has to be, you know, a lot of, especially when we're talking about the stuff that brings us, it has the potential to bring us the most shame and the most guilt about our past behaviors or our current behaviors. I mean, I tell a story in the addiction inoculation about the rituals I had around drinking, and looking back on them and having some distance from them, they're so insane. Like from my perspective, looking back now, I'm like, I cannot believe I was doing some of the things I do, but the way I have to tell that story is with humor. Otherwise it gets all tangled up in shame and guilt. And we have no room for that in this conversation, because that's what keeps people from talking about it, from talking about it with their kids. So there has to be some humor in there somewhere.
So you got me curious as you were giving your list of things that you had done, and you hit on one spot. You said your favorite teaching job ever was in a adolescent rehab unit or facility. And most people would say that does not sound like fun. Why was that such, it jumped right out of your mouth, that was my favorite teaching experience ever. Like about that?
I've figured out that when you get kids who, and to make this very, very clear, for the most part, we adults have wrecked them in some way. We have ruined their learning opportunities. We have told them that they're worthless. We've failed to realize that they have learning issues. Many of the kids in my classroom, you know, some of the biggest risk factors for substance use disorder are, you know, academic failure, social ostracism, things like that, early aggression in childhood. But those are all feed into each other and sort of self-perpetuate each other. You can imagine that if you have a kid who's failing academically, they may also get aggressive, or they may be socially ostracized, or, you know, they all sort of fold into each other. And so often, and, you know, undiagnosed learning issues are also a massive risk factor for substance use disorder. And so there were often a lot of kids in my classroom that had come out of foster care, group care, at some sort of, you know, system that hadn't always treated them the best. They had often had undiagnosed learning issues and been told that they're stupid. They were made to have very low self-worth. Many of them had no feelings of self-efficacy. And self-efficacy is this feeling that if you want the circumstances in your life to change, if you want your behaviors to change, or if you want circumstances around you to change, that you can take action and that something will change out there. And so many of these kids have had so little control over their lives that they have learned on a very deep level that no matter what they do, things will continue on the same as they are. And those low feelings of self-efficacy are also a risk factor for substance use disorder. So the reason I loved the job, loved that job and would still be doing it if they hadn't closed up the adolescent unit, is that it strips teaching down to its most essential, what teaching is at its essence, which is getting kids to trust you and getting kids engaged on any level. So often for me, I had kids who, now imagine, you know, you're a teenager and you have to go to rehab and most kids are not that excited about that.
No.
And then you also tell them that in order to graduate from rehab, you have to participate meaningfully in school. And some of the kids have dropped out of school. So from their perspective, why on earth should they have to do school? And then I show up and I'm like, hi, I'm your teacher and I'm going to make you do stuff. And, you know, I'm the last person they want to be around, right? And let alone trust me, like, who am I? I show up and they don't know who I am. So I have to earn their trust and I have to engage them in some way. And that means that I hardly ever was able to use plan A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I usually was somewhere down in the lower end of the alphabet by the time I figured out what was going to work that day, because it all had to do with, you know, where everyone was. And being a trauma-informed teacher is a very big part of that, understanding not just, oh, they're being bad, I have to send them out of the room, but, oh, they're being, quote, bad, what's causing this behavior? And understanding that often they're testing me to see if I will send them out of the room or if I will abandon them, so that they can then turn around and say, oh, look, see, there you go, another adult I can't trust. So the one thing I couldn't do was give up on them. So I like education stripped down to its base elements, and the trust and engagement are the two base elements of teaching. Is it easy? Absolutely not. But on the other hand, grades weren't a part of it. We were just sort of trying to keep them engaged and moving forward in their education in some way. So I get to take away grades, that extrinsic motivator. And most of the time we weren't dealing with their parents or caregivers or guardians either. It was just the kids, just trust, just engagement. And that was my job. It was perfect.
It's powerful. It's powerful. Yeah. If you're just joining us today, my guest is New York Times bestselling author Jessica Leahy. Jessica is a Line One favorite, having joined me for discussions about her bestselling books, The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation, which we are discussing a little bit here today. I want to remind folks, if you're listening, that we are recording this show, and so we will not be able to take phone calls or emails when you're listening to this. All right, Jessica, we talked. I mean, I do want to get a little bit more into the addiction inoculation a little bit later, but I'd just like to give you a chance to really talk about your own journey and how you came to that realization for yourself that alcohol didn't work for you anymore.
I don't really know that it ever did. So I was born into a family with a long, long line of people with substance use disorder, issues with substance use disorder on both sides. My husband's got it going on in both sides of his family as well. One of my parents is an alcoholic now, thankfully in recovery. And the one thing I was absolutely sure of as a kid is that I would never, ever be like them. Period, full stop, wasn't going to happen. I didn't understand anything about genetics of substance use disorder. I didn't understand any of that stuff. I just knew there's no way I was going to end up like them. And so I was really, I was always the caretaker. I was always the designated driver. I was always the one that held the hair back when other people barfed into the bushes, you know, that kind of thing. And really just didn't do a lot of drinking as a kid. And was really had a perfectly reasonable relationship with alcohol until I had my own kids. And, I don't like to pin it on any one thing. I sort of think that it was a variety of conditions, but I had a husband who was going out into the world every day and saving people's lives. And I was at home taking care of kids. And this is after having gone to law school and after having been in the workforce. And it wasn't that I didn't love being a mom. I just, I just wasn't out there saving people's lives, I guess. So, you know, sort of this, it was all, this is all about me. This is no, you know, being a stay-at-home parent is one of the best things I've ever done for the period of time that I did it.
But Jessica, knowing you, the little bit that I do and just talking to you, but seeing all the things that you were involved with and all the incredible, interesting, you know, curiosity that you have, your brain seems like it would, I don't know, kind of not know what to do with itself.
I mean, luckily, as I said, my husband was doing medicine that I was interested in and had worked in that field as well. So I was getting a lot of sort of, oh, what's going on? You tell me all about your day. But I was also alone a lot because in medical training, you know, it's long, long hours. Luckily, I had my parents around for part of it and my husband's parents around for part of it. But, you know, and I think another part of it was it became a habit that spiraled out of control. And so, you know, noticing that I was having an extra glass a day turned into an extra bottle a day, which turned into, you know, me pre-gaming before my husband got home from work so that I could have the quote normal amount of alcohol once he got home, but I was already well in the bag before he ever got home, you know, that kind of stuff. And
pre-gaming,
I was also very, very
pre-gaming is getting a head start
ahead of time.
Getting a head start on things. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have to say that's, you know, I don't miss drinking. I don't crave drinks. I don't, you know, that kind of thing. But I do miss, as someone who can have some social anxiety from time to time, I do miss that I can't have a glass or two of wine before I go out to like a dinner party so that I can walk into the door feeling a little more chill. I do miss that because it does make the social lubrication is a real thing. But on the other hand, I had to deal with my social anxiety on a base level. Like I had to actually deal with my anxiety, right, my social anxiety, my imposter syndrome at its root, as opposed to just covering up every time I was uncomfortable with it. So that's been good. But anyway, just sort of slid out of control. I can't point to exactly when, but it happened pretty quickly. And luckily I was only in a really bad place for about 5 years. So yeah.
Yeah. How did that moment come where you decided, nope?
You know, I talk about getting to the place where you know you need help as being like a 100-piece puzzle. And you can't, piece 100 can't fall into place and complete the picture unless pieces 1 through 99 are already there. So lots of little things had happened along the way. And a lot of it was some of the stuff I saw as a kid. Some of it was seeing relatives. Some of it was hearing, you know, seeing other people, all those little pieces. And then in the last, you know, 5 years or so, I'd say, you know, the last 20 pieces fell into place fairly quickly. But I wasn't ready until I was ready. And I was very fortunate in that my dad just happened to be piece 100. It wasn't like he'd never said anything before. It was just, I got very drunk at my mom's birthday party, which happens to be my sober date, not coincidentally. I got very drunk at my mom's, blackout drunk at my mom's birthday party. And my dad came up the next morning and confronted me about it. And he said, you know, I know what an alcoholic looks like, and you're an alcoholic and you need help. And it wasn't that my dad was the magic factor. It wasn't that, you know, it was piece 100, right place, right time. I was ready. I had no excuses. And I went to my first meeting that night. And I'm just really grateful. And it was 10 years ago on June 7th of this past year. So of 2023. So I'm 10 years in now, and I'm still really grateful to my dad for being that 100th piece. But I have to say, I'm also super grateful for 1 through 99, because he couldn't have been 100 without the other ones.
No, they're all important.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to jump into, I do want to jump into more of, I want to talk about the addiction inoculation briefly and the gift of failure, just touch on that. And then I want to get into really some of this other interesting stuff that I'm not aware of, or what you're doing, which I just sort of caught some information on it. So we'll get into that, but we are up against our first break. So if you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times bestselling author Jessica Leahy. Jessica is a Line One favorite, at least one of my favorites, having joined me for discussion about her best-selling books, The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation which are both great reads. Today's discussion is about more about Jessica herself, about the journey she's taken to get to this place and the work she continues to do on behalf of children and families. A short note, we are pre-recording this show, so we won't be able to take phone calls today. After this short break, we'll return for more of our discussion with Jessica Leahy. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and this is Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality childcare creates futures for families, children, and the state's economy. When children are safe, engaged, and learning, parents can work and everyone has a better outcome. Thread has resources to support your family in their childcare search. Knowing what to look for in a licensed facility is important for the safety of your children. Thread also offers parenting resources and support. To learn more about quality childcare in Alaska, visit threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by Thread.
Today's episode of Line One, Your Health Connection, was pre-recorded. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during the show.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is New York Times bestselling author Jessica Leahy. Jessica has been on the show several times before, always a great interview, so I would encourage you to go and find those in our archives. We've had some great discussions about her books and her life. All right, today we are talking a little bit more about Jessica herself and what she's doing and some of the new work that she's getting into. And so we're gonna go ahead and dig into that a little bit. I want you to remember, if you're listening today, this program is pre-recorded and we won't be accepting phone calls or emails. All right, Jessica, I want to talk about The Gift of Failure for a second. That book, I read it, and it just made me look at a lot of things differently and the way that we, not necessarily helicopter parent these days, but snowplow parent. And that book had a lot of humor in it and a lot of really good lessons. And I had some parents read it and they're like, this is amazing. And then other parents were like, no. One lady told me, I don't like that book. She's like, I'm not going to let him fail. It is my job to get him through high school and I will drag him through all the way. I'm like, okay.
Yep.
So The Gift, how many years has that been? When did that come out?
That came out in 2015. So it's been out there for a while and I get those messages all the time because I still tour around the country and I'm in a lot of schools and I take off in a couple of weeks for an extended tour on the road and I'm still out there talking about it and still hearing both.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. This has changed my relationship with my kid or changed the way my kid thinks about learning or, this is all well and good, but my kid can't fail at anything because the stakes are so high that, blah, blah, blah. And so, that's a message I hear all the time.
What is just for anybody who might not be familiar with it or didn't catch our show on that a while back, what's the basic premise of the book? Can you give us the short version of what the ideas are, the principles?
Yeah, so I was teaching middle school at the time and noticing that many of the parents of my students were sort of either undermining some learning opportunities or saving kids from the consequences of mistakes they'd made. So the kids were getting the opportunity to learn from those mistakes and it was getting really frustrating. But then I had this sort of moment where I had to take a look at my own parenting practices and realize I was doing the same thing to my own kids. So I was writing for The Atlantic at the time and I was really curious about what we can call it overparenting, we can call it overly directive or controlling parenting, any term you really want, but they're shadings on the same theme. And what that does not only to kids' motivation, what happens when you're to their learning, their potential to learn. And it turns out that it has a huge impact, not just on their motivation, and but also, as I said, their ability to learn over time and how they react when they have those inevitable missteps, failures, whatever. And the research at the time was mostly on motivation, but didn't link together with the research on learning and how we learn as human beings and the impact that that kind of parenting has. So I changed not just a lot about my parenting after doing the research for The Gift of Failure. I did a lot of changes. I made a lot of changes in my classroom as well. And all of that, I think it made me a much better teacher. And I hope it also made me a better or at least more responsive parent.
Yeah, the book talks a lot about developing or kids developing intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation, right? And that's what you're talking about. If parents are always moving obstacles out of the way and making it easy, there's that sense of resilience, determination, overcoming obstacles. I mean, that sense of and a sense of agency and power, right? Like,
yeah, there's actually sort of two parts to this. So the extrinsic, intrinsic. So extrinsic means things that come from outside you, whereas intrinsic means things that generate from inside of you. And, you know, I'm intrinsically motivated to write because I love being a writer. I'm intrinsically motivated to go out and work in my garden because I love doing it. Extrinsic motivators are things like grades, points, scores, trophies, money, all of that kind of stuff, trying to influence people's behavior from outside. But that could also be things like surveillance, control, controlling, reading kids' emails, you know, all that kind of stuff that we do in order to try to control kids' behavior. And that actually undermines kids' motivation, anyone's motivation, actually, not just kids, to do the things that we're trying to get them to do. And it undermines their creativity as well. It has a huge impact on creativity. So there's that one side of it, like the very things that we use to try to control kids' behavior actually make them less likely to want to do the thing we're trying to get them to do, whether it's sticker charts or grades or paying them for their grades or whatever. And then the other side of it is, that when we're overly directive of kids, when we give them the answers rather than helping them find the answers themselves or make the mistakes that they really need to make along the way to figure out how to do something for themselves, it makes them less comfortable with the frustration. It makes them less likely to be able to rely on themselves and feel like they can manage those feelings of frustration. And so it makes them less likely to be able to finish tasks that are challenging for them. And the problem with that is that some of the most powerful teaching tools I have as a teacher require this sort of ability to feel a little bit frustrated and to be able to rely on themselves and complete a task that's challenging. This tool I'm talking about is called Desirable Difficulties. It's written about beautifully in a book called Make It Stick out of Harvard University Press. And those, if you think about who's going to be able to benefit from desirable difficulties, it's not kids who give up really quickly because they're frustrated by their inability to do it right away. It's kids who can actually push through, rely on themselves, take a breath, reread the directions, you know, figure out, oh, no, I can do this. I think I can figure it out. So there's an impact on learning, there's an impact on motivation, and they're slightly different shadings of the same topic.
Yeah, I read an interesting study, and I can't remember the school. I want to say it's Harvard, or it wasn't a study. It was an interview with, I think, a admissions person. They were talking about the kids' ability, like coming to college ready. These days, and they were talking about different socioeconomic status, right? And the thing that they've noticed recently in the last 10 to 15 years, kids from higher affluent, you know, households and with all the privilege, they do not have that sort of determination, resiliency. It's the kids that are coming from, you know, lower income areas where maybe parents are working two jobs or, I mean, that there's some value in the struggle.
Yes, although I do think we have to be really careful with that, sort of making those kind of statements, in that there's different forms of over-parenting or helicopter parenting or whatever you want to call it. There's people who feel like, you know, maybe you're a white person of privilege and you feel like you have every right to walk into that teacher's office or their administrator's office and pound your desk, your fist on the desk and say, you know, you will not discipline my child without my permission or whatever, or my kid cannot get a B minus or lower, or they're going to lose their scholarship to whatever. So those are parents who feel like they have that external power. But then there are some parents that do not feel welcome inside of the schools, or there's a language barrier, or they don't feel like they have that. So there's another kind of helicopter parenting or over parenting, which is just controlling the kid inside the house, inside the domain that you feel powerful within. So there are different ways this can look. And yes, there are some blanket generalizations we can make, but I'm always really leery of those generalizations.
Super good to be cautious. The controlling in the home, what does that do to kids when you have a kid that doesn't have that sense of choice or power or agency, and they have one or two parents that are really just sort of, you know, do as I say, not as, or, you know, kids are supposed to be seen and not heard.
Yeah, there's two parts to that. So kids who think about how little autonomy, and when I say autonomy, I don't just mean like control or independence. I mean like control over the details of their lives. Mm-hmm. And think about how little control kids have in general, and teens, even when they're supposed to have more and more, that as a natural part of adolescence, there's still a lot of adolescents that don't have much autonomy in their lives. And then during COVID, that became our worlds became even smaller. And a lot of parents like me, I had so little control over my kids being safe out there in the world. I started to exert even more control in my house, and gave them even less autonomy. Those kids tend to feel like they just don't have anything of their own. They're not able to exert the independence they need in order to become full, you know, competent adults. And they also, a lot of them didn't feel like they were able to develop this thing called self-efficacy. Again, the feeling that if I take action, I can make this effect. And those kids, whether it's because they were the kids in my classroom, in my drug and alcohol rehab classroom, where they had no control because they were being shuttled from one house to another, group home to group home by the state, or because they had all the riches in the world and all the privilege in the world, but the parents gave them no ability to make decisions, to do things their way, to try things on their own. So it happens across the spectrum, and those kids end up just having what my friend Julie Lithcott-Hames, who wrote another wonderful book about this topic called How to Raise an Adult, she calls it, I love this term so much, existential impotence. She used to be a dean at Stanford, a freshman dean at Stanford, and she would get these kids in her office and they just couldn't even make decisions, didn't know how to like handle interpersonal conflict, how to make decisions about what they wanted. They just had always been told what they wanted and they didn't know how to handle it. Now that they were being asked, what do you want? They couldn't deal with that.
Yeah. Vander Kolk. I mean, you're talking the self-efficacy. Bessel van der Kolk calls that the sense of agency, right? And the power that we have.
Yeah, agency. So they're definitely related.
Yeah. To take action, to create, to get safe for ourselves, right? Or to influence our world. And I see a lot of kids. You can create really compliant little children with that kind of like rigid, hard parenting. But when they get to be 13 or 14, there's generally a different, they start to push back, right?
You can actually do the exact opposite too. You can create really defiant kids with that. I had a kid that I taught at the rehab. I asked him to write an essay about what he thinks of himself, like who he thinks he is as a person, and then how other people see him. And he would not write the essay about how other people see him. And at first he wouldn't tell me why. And it created this huge explosion in the classroom. I actually got to write about this in an anthology once. And it turns out that the reason he wasn't willing to write that essay is that he said, why would I write that essay? Everyone thinks I'm going to end up in jail like all the other men in my family. So why stay sober? Why follow the rules? Why go to school? I'm just going to end up in prison. So I have no control over that. So why would I make any decisions in my life in order to make my life more difficult? So you can end up with that situation.
He had already internalized that message.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's powerful. All right. So the addiction inoculation, that's a book that when I first saw the title, I thought absolute gold, right? It's genius because getting ahead, I mean, so many of substance abuse problems, I mean, your situation's a little bit different. It didn't crank up until later in life, but that's the exception. Generally they start early.
I thought so. I mean, yes and no. Once I got into recovery, it turns out my story is a lot more common than I thought. Yeah. I thought I was this crazy exception, but yeah, a lot of kids, you know, the younger a kid starts using drugs and alcohol, the higher their lifelong risk of developing substance use disorder. So if you have a kid who first starts drinking or using drugs in eighth grade, they have like a 50% lifelong risk of developing substance use disorder. But if we can put that off, you know, if they can put it off till 10th grade, they cut that risk in half. And then if they can put it off until 12th grade, they cut it in half again. It's a really, that delay message is really powerful.
That's an important one to drive home.
Yeah.
Because it does. I mean, you just start off if you can just push it back. And I hear a lot of folks are saying, oh, well, you know, I'd rather have them drink at home. I'd rather, you know, just I'd rather be in control where I can have the keys. Right. I mean, there is some well-intentioned parenting behind that.
Oh, of
that
course.
Approach.
And this I have to make super clear. We do the best we can do with the information that we have.
Right.
I admit freely in the addiction inoculation that I gave my kid sips. I've given my kid sips of alcohol. I did all those things. And which is the reason I wanted to research this book as deeply as I did, because I wanted to know, are we just crossing our fingers and hoping this will work? Or what does the science say?
Yeah.
And it turns out that doing what you just mentioned, whether that's, you know, saying, well, they're going to do it anyway, I might as well take the keys and keep them safe. Unfortunately, that raises their risk. That's what's called being permissive around drugs and alcohol. And not only are you raising the risk for your own kids, but if you're involving other kids in it, you're raising their risk as well.
It is. It's hard to be the parent that is hard-nosed on alcohol for their 17, 18-year-old. I've noticed because there's a lot of kids that are drinking and there's no way to really police that. But if you're the parent, I mean, how do you approach that with your kids if you're the non-permissive parent?
Yeah. So, and first of all, I'm never going to be the cool parent. You know, I hope that my kids know that I love them and that I want what's best for them. And so to that end, we've been talking, you know, and as I said, I didn't research this book until my kids were in their teens. But I hope because I've talked to them so much about it, not just their genetic predisposition, but what they know the research almost as well as I do at this point. So if I were to do anything other than say, no, not until this substance is legal for you, which I actually don't care about the legality as much as I do their brain development, which, you know, legality is a proxy for no, not until your brain is almost finished developing, which doesn't happen until the early to mid 20s. If I were to do anything other than that, and they're privy to the same information that I'm privy to, then what I'm saying is, yeah, I know that I'm reducing your risk by keeping, you know, making this a no alcohol, no drinking household for you guys and for me. But if I were to do anything else, I'd just be taking the easy way out. And that's not what I signed up for when I signed up to be a parent, you know, if especially given their higher genetic risk. So we just talk about it a lot. And that's why the best and most effective substance use prevention programs that we know of start as young as possible, and specifically in preschool and kindergarten.
And I think you started to see some of that with the smoking programs that they pushed out, and everybody's like, oh, yeah, just say no. But they really started targeting teens in different ways around the smoking, and smoking became kind of uncool over time. And vaping sort of came in, but smoking went out.
You know, I think we have a lot of work to do around, you know, we helped kids understand that the tobacco industry was lying to us. And I think we haven't yet gotten there with the understanding. There's a fantastic, fantastic episode of the Huberman Lab podcast about alcohol in the brain. He also does nicotine in the brain and he does cannabis in the brain. Those three episodes I recommend so frequently because alcohol is toxic to the body. It's a carcinogen that does all kinds of things that we're not really talking about yet because it's such a cultural norm for us, just like smoking was such a cultural norm for us. So I think we're we're moving things in the right direction, but we still have a lot of distance to go before we help kids see just how valuable their brand loyalty is and the reason that the beer companies are paying as much as they are to put their logo on, all over the place on the Super Bowl. That early brand loyalty is worth a lot of money to them. And, helping kids understand how the media manipulates them in order to sell them stuff is one of the really important steps I talk about in the book.
All right. I want to get to what you're doing now and what you're doing moving forward, but we are up against our 40-minute break. So if you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times bestselling author Jessica Leahy. Jessica is joining us again on line one, and we've discussed a little bit about the gift of failure and the addiction inoculation, which are both really good reads for parents. Today, we're discussing more about Jessica and the work that she's doing currently. After this short break, we return for more of our discussion. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and this is Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Today's episode of Line One, Your Health Connection was pre-recorded. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during the show.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in today, my guest is New York Times bestselling author Jessica Leahy. Jessica is one of my all-time favorite guests and a really, really enjoyable author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation. Today we're talking about Jessica's life, her own choice to give up alcohol, and also like really what kind of work is she doing? She's always doing something interesting and new. So I am frankly curious to find out what those things are. So Jessica, what's the latest stuff you're doing? You mentioned traveling a lot and going to schools. Can we start there? What's that about?
So I get to do a lot of speaking around the gift of failure and learning and motivation. And I love that. I love going into schools and talking about that stuff. But what I really, really feel is the thing I'm supposed to be doing is talking about the substance use prevention stuff. And so it can be more difficult to get people to listen to that topic because it's scary, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of shame and guilt around it. You don't want to go to an event around that because you don't want someone to see you there and think that you're there because you think your kid has a problem, all that kind of stuff. So the nice thing is that a lot of the subjects in The Gift of Failure dovetail really nicely. Right. A lot of what I talk about in The Gift of Failure, like building self-efficacy and self-advocacy and refusal skills, all of that stuff is really also preventative against substance use disorder. So what a lot of schools have been hiring me to do lately is to use The Gift of Failure, that topic, and talk about that, but also use it as a little bit of a Trojan horse to kind of sneak some of the substance use prevention work in there.
I like it.
Whether, it's great because, the two really do fit together nicely. And the other issue is that just a lot of kids are really hurting right now. Between COVID and the mental health crisis that late adolescents and kids and people in their 20s are facing, there's a lot to talk about right now. And it's been a real struggle for me to figure out how to help as many kids as possible and how to get the information out. So yes, I'm still traveling and doing a lot of that. But a friend of mine said to me, you know, if it's hard to get people to listen to the substance use prevention stuff because they're just scared of it, give it to them in a form that they can listen to privately at home. So I started making daily 90-second videos on my Instagram Reels. I'm Teacher Leahy there. And on TikTok, I'm at Jessica Leahy there. And I, every single day, there's a new video. And if you go to jessicaleahy.com, there's a big table of contents under the menu video that has like all 170 episodes of the addiction inoculation stuff. Cause I don't care how you get this information. I just want people to have access to it. So if you go to one of my events, great. If you listen to an interview, great. If you watch these daily videos in the privacy of your own home, great. I just want people to start thinking a little more critically about the things we think are true. Like, you know, does giving kids sips of alcohol at home help them learn to be more moderate drinkers later? And the answer is absolutely not. It raises their risk for substance use disorder. And I love it when people argue with me about it because I've got the receipts. And especially if they come at me with that one a lot. And especially when people come at me with the whole, but look at Europe. I just want my kids to be like those European kids. And there's, I can give you a bajillion different reasons, but the big ones are, you know, it's very, you can't teach moderation to someone that can't be moderate around drugs and alcohol. And, you know, as a region, as both a region and, anyway, as an area of the world, the European Union has the highest rates of both illness and death attributable to substance, to alcohol. So, of the highest drinking rates in the world.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, it kind of lines up.
They have the highest rates of alcohol consumption in the world, the highest rates of illness attributable to alcohol, and the highest rates of deaths attributable to alcohol in the world.
All right. Well, that takes the...
And we can get granular. In fact, what was so funny is I got so much pushback about that, that I had to make an additional 10 videos getting in really granular about the data and going country by country in order to talk about it, because the European Union as a whole is not a monolith. So I had to get into, like, you know, Germany versus Italy versus France for, you know, it, all of that. So
and everybody
anyway,
was
it,
like,
it's
no,
all there.
That's not true. That's not true. And then you're like, no, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And all of that data comes from the World Health Organization, Europe.
Yeah. So it's not just stuff you've found on some obscure, obscure website.
No.
Are these videos that 90 second? I'd love, I'm going to go check them out, but I do want to give you time at the end to give us some of your favorite resources and to certainly give people the ways that they can find these things. So I want people to have, when they're listening to this, to have a pencil and paper. We have your website on, you know, it'll be posted, on our show page. So they should be able to find most of this stuff through your website, correct?
Yeah. And actually, I'll make things even easier for you. If you go to jessicaleahy.com under speaking, there's a big button that says download speaking bibliography. And it's literally my favorite resources on every topic I cover, from education to the adolescent brain to, you know, the alcohol and drug stuff. It's all there. And I update it constantly. They're all links.
And it's all based on the research that you've done and studying all this. I mean, these are your favorites. Sounds like a great resource.
Yeah. And I'm constantly adding to it. There's a book sitting right next to me called Autonomy Supportive Parenting by Emily Edlin. That I just added a new book by Devorah Heitner called Growing Up in Public that I just added. Whenever new stuff comes out that I really love, I try to get that on there.
How many books do you read in a year? Do you count them?
I love to read, but here's my secret. I'm also really hyper. I love to be out in the woods chopping wood. I love to be working in the garden. So I actually do a lot of audiobooks. And often when I'm researching for my own work, I listen to the audiobook and I have a hard copy of the book so I can have lots of notes in the margins and stuff like that. But usually if I'm out in the garden, I have a notebook with me. And so my notebooks are all covered with dirt and there's usually little, you know, pebbles stuck in the spine because I'm trying to multitask in the most messy way possible.
You have a busy mind, my friend. It's got to be occupied. So the videos, the 90s, are they targeted towards teens? Are they targeted towards adults? Like what's the audience?
The audience is educators and parents mainly, because that's who I write my books for. I get asked all the time, since you brought it up, about resources for teens specifically, or especially around substance use disorder. I would write it, but I think the book that I love the most on this topic has been written, and it's by David and Nick Sheff, called High. David Sheff wrote Beautiful Boy. Nick Sheff is the beautiful boy. He's in recovery now. And he and Nick, David and Nick wrote this beautiful, wonderful book called High, that even the kids at the rehab, who are some of the most jaded kids on the planet around drugs and alcohol and like people trying to tell them anything, they really like this book. And I'm going to beg parents and educators, if you buy this book and if you want your kids to read it, please don't like really push it on them and say, hey, I heard about this book, I think you should read it. Just leave it where they'll find it. It's really well written. It's really bright colors. It's really, you just get sucked into it. So don't get your parents stink all over it. Just leave it somewhere where your kids will find it and hopefully pick it up on their own so they can think it's their idea.
Your parents stink. I haven't heard that. But it perfectly like lights up everything that we do, that our kids go, like,
Yeah. That's... The one book I really, really wanted both of my kids to read, because I loved it as a kid, was A Wrinkle in Time. And I pushed it and pushed it and pushed it. And the one book that neither of my children have read is A Wrinkle in Time, I think on principle, because I pushed it too hard.
I bet they saw the movie though.
Nope.
They're just still got parents.
At this point, I think it's just a grudge match. I don't know.
All right. Okay. So we got about 6 or 7 minutes left, and I'd like to give you a chance to give out any of your favorite resources. But it sounds like we can get on Jessica Leahy on your website and absolutely find all of those. But I'd also like you to kind of think, like, what's this work that you've done with parents and kids really taught you, like, I guess, as a summation of your life's work to this point?
You know, the thing that I love about what I get to do often when I go to a school, for example, or into a community, is I get to speak often to the kids during the day. During school. And then often I'll talk to the faculty at the professional, in like a professional development session. And by the way, most professional development in education is awful. So my life's goal is to provide good professional development. And then I get to talk to the community, parents, whomever, in the evening. And what's great about that is my job, when I get to talk to all of these parties, is to get the conversation started between these parties. So I'll always give my email out to all of the kids and ask them to email me before that evening, when I'm going to talk to their parents, and tell me what they really feel like their parents need to hear that they're not hearing, either because they get too defensive or they get argumentative or they're just not hearing for whatever reason. And I get to teach kids about things like ways to approach their parents that are less, that are, don't confront the parent as much, don't lead to the as much defensiveness, like I statements. Mom, I would love to sit down with you. I need to have a conversation with you. And I would love for you to really listen to me, and to make I statements like, when you do X, it makes me feel Y. And so then when I speak to the parents in the evening, not only can I tell them about the things that their kids emailed me about, and believe me, if you give your email address to, let's say, 1,000 middle school students, you get the best emails ever. And, you know, just between us and everyone listening, really, they tell me one of about 20 things. It's, you know, there's a really discrete number of comments that they make. But so not only can I tell the parents what their kids really want them to know, I can also say, look, I've taught your kids about I statements, and I've taught your kids about ways to come to you so that you will, they can feel like they're being heard. Because one of the comments I get most from kids is that they don't know who it is that their parent thinks they're raising, but it's not them. Like that their parents don't know them, that their parents don't listen to them, that maybe they feel like they're parenting some imaginary version of a kid that they don't really have. And so when those parents, so I say to the parents, you know, when your kid comes to you with like an I statement, like, Mom, when you do X, it makes me feel Y, that I specifically taught them that, or someone taught them that. And that means that you need to listen because this is important. So just kind of, you know, greasing the wheels a little bit so that people are more likely to hear each other and to give everyone the same vocabulary so that when a kid comes to a parent, they actually are meeting each other in a place where they can both be understood. And same thing with teachers as well. You know, I got to write this column for the New York Times for 3 years called the Parent Teacher Conference. And my job was to bring up with teachers things that parents wanted to say, but were too afraid to say, and to bring up with parents things that teachers wanted to say that they were too afraid to say, and to meet at that intersection. And those intersections of parenting, education, all of that, that's my favorite place to live, to start those conversations.
What do you think? I think a lot about one of the best lessons I ever had, and I still struggle with it, is to not be dismissive of my children's feelings. To stay away from, you don't need to feel that way, or don't be that upset about that, or it's not that big of a deal. And somebody told me, I forget who it was, but just about, you know, validation and curiosity. And
yeah,
it doesn't mean that your kid's right or rational or whatever, but just to be able to hear them.
And sometimes Lisa Demore, who's out there right now, really popular with a couple of, she has a book called The Emotional Lives of Teenagers. She has a book called Under Pressure. She has a book called Untangled about the 7 phases of raising daughters. They're all wonderful books. And she talks a lot about the fact that sometimes teenagers especially don't want us to solve their problems for them. They just want to talk about them. And, you know, it's really something to get smacked in the face with that when your kid comes to you, and my daughter has done this as well, come to me and said, you know, I really just need for you to listen to me right now. It's not that I'm looking for a solution. I just need for you to hear me. And we underestimate I want to fix it. I want to fix the stuff. I want to solve the problem, fix the stuff. There's a reason I have magic wands. I have on the wall behind me, because I say this in interviews or when I'm consulting with parents all the time. I wish I could wave a magic wand for you and make this better, but I can't do that. This is going to be about you and your kid and hearing each other. And and that's sort of, my job is to make sure the kids are heard and seen and known and loved for who they are and not who we wish they were. And that is like, just like the teaching thing, when I said, you know, teaching at the rehab is like the essence of teaching. That's at the very essence what my job is to help kids be seen and heard and known and loved for who they are and not who we wish they were. That's it right there. That's my job.
It's a brave new world. And I think parenting has gotten a lot harder. With all this,
it's gotten it. There are more voices. I'm complicit in that. There are more voices telling us what to do, but we also have a media that wants us to be scared all the time of all the things that could go wrong. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're up into our last minute here, and I just any take home thoughts or things you want to let people know?
As someone who has recently waved goodbye to her kids, you know, my kids are now, in fact, my daughter's coming home and turning 20 this weekend. Yeah. So I'm out of this. It's really, really fun to see the fruits of a long-term parenting strategy. I've made so many mistakes, and yet over and over and over again, I cannot take my wins in those short-term moments. It's the long-term stuff, like seeing my kids be able to rely on themselves as they go out into the world. That's where we really can finally look back and say, okay, I did some things okay. I'm all right now.
All right, Jessica, I love your energy and your passion for the work that you do and for making my job really easy. Thank you for coming again.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much for asking me again.
Absolutely. I look forward to getting you on when your next piece of work is out. All right. My thanks to my producer and audio engineer, Madeline Rose. Thanks to all of you for listening today. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day, Alaska.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.